Happy spring to those who are listening in the Northern Hemisphere. Welcome to the April 7th, 2026 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here to give you a quick summary of what's new on annals.org. People who have suffered through the painful passing of a kidney stone are very eager for strategies to prevent recurrence. Advice often includes changes in diet, fluid intake, and medications. Some even advocate surveillance imaging to catch stones before they become symptomatic. But studies evaluating these interventions have come to variable conclusions. The first article I'll highlight is a systematic review that aims to bring some coherence to the evidence on strategies to prevent recurrent kidney stones. Researchers from the Research Triangle Institute and University of North Carolina Evidence-Based Practice Center searched the literature for clinical studies assessing the benefits and harms of diet, pharmacologic therapy, and surveillance imaging to prevent recurrent kidney stones. They found and evaluated 31 studies involving non-pregnant adults and a small number of children. They found that increased water intake, diets with normal to high calcium but low sodium and animal protein, and medications including thiazides, alkali therapy, and allopurinol may reduce stone recurrence in adults with calcium oxalate or calcium phosphate stones, although evidence was generally limited. No studies evaluated imaging as a prevention tool, and data on children were very scarce. Overall, the review concludes that while several approaches may provide at least a small benefit, more research is needed to confirm the effectiveness of some interventions and clarify potential harms. Among the advances in breast cancer treatment is the use of pegfilgrastim to address chemotherapy-induced neutropenia. Unfortunately, administration of this drug induces substantial bone pain. The next article reports a trial that sought to determine whether modification of the timing of administration could help to reduce pegfilgrastim-induced bone pain. Researchers from Southern Medical University and Guangdong Medical University in China randomized 159 patients with stage 1 through 3 breast cancer receiving their first cycle of chemotherapy to receive pegfilgrastim 24, 48, or 72 hours post-chemotherapy infusion. They then collected data on patients' worst daily bone pain over 5 days and tracked severe pain and infection-related complications. Trial results showed that patients who received pegfilgrastim at 72 hours reported significantly less overall pain and far fewer cases of severe pain, while rates of neutropenia and fever-related complications were similar across groups. The findings suggest that administering the drug at 72 hours may meaningfully improve the overall treatment experience for patients without added risk. Next is a report from the SURPASS-SWITCH trial, a trial that examines outcomes in persons with inadequately controlled type 2 diabetes on dulaglutide who escalated dulaglutide dose versus switched to tirzepatide. Other analyses have reported outcomes related to glycemic control and weight loss. The current analysis focuses on patient-reported outcomes. Researchers from Eli Lilly and Company collected data on measures of health and weight-related quality of life, including a measure of emotional effect of diabetes treatment. Both groups improved, but those who switched to tirzepatide reported greater gains across nearly all measures. These patients felt more positive, more in control of their condition, and less fearful or frustrated. The findings suggest that tirzepatide may offer broad benefits beyond glucose control, helping patients feel better both physically and emotionally. Effective therapies for people who suffer prolonged symptoms following acute COVID infection remain elusive. Fatigue is one of long COVID's most persistent and debilitating symptoms. Researchers from the Brazilian Biomedical Research Institute and colleagues assessed the efficacy of fluvoxamine and metformin for fatigue attributed to long COVID in a randomized trial that enrolled 399 people at 22 outpatient sites in Brazil between October 2023 and February 2025. Eligible participants had been experiencing fatigue for at least 90 days after infection and were assigned to fluvoxamine, metformin, or placebo for 60 days. Researchers measured changes using a standard fatigue severity scale. Fluvoxamine produced a meaningful reduction in fatigue by day 60, with continued improvement at day 90, and also boosted overall quality of life scores. Metformin did not show any significant effect. While all treatments were generally safe, fluvoxamine had fewer reported adverse events. The authors conclude that fluvoxamine may offer a viable treatment option for long COVID-related fatigue, though longer-term effects remain unknown. However, an important limitation of the study was the absence of assessment for a history of depression at baseline, thus whether the treatment effect was due to a direct effect on long COVID or to an effect on baseline depression is uncertain. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act implemented Medicaid work requirements for beneficiaries in some states, but congressional policymakers are considering extending work requirements nationally to all Medicaid enrollees. Next is a study that estimates the potential consequences if the U.S. Congress were to impose Medicaid work requirements across the country. Researchers from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center analyzed data from the 2022 to 2023 Medical Expenditure Panel Survey to understand the health and functional status of adults aged 19 to 54 who did not meet typical exemption criteria and worked less than 20 hours a week, who could lose Medicaid if federal work requirements were implemented. They found that about 8.3 million people, or 50% of this group, would be at risk of disenrollment. These adults had higher levels of physical, neuropsychological, and independent living impairments and were more likely to report poor physical and mental health compared to those meeting work requirements. The authors conclude that many enrollees who are vulnerable to losing coverage have health challenges significant enough to limit their ability to meet work hour rules, even if they do not qualify as formally disabled. The findings underscore the importance of revising exemption criteria to account for functional impairment and medical vulnerability. Firearm injury is a public health issue in the United States. As with other public health issues, screening for risk is important to guide prevention efforts. The next article reports the validation of the four-item 10-point safety score, a tool to identify a patient's risk of firearm violence. The study took place in four Level 1 emergency departments in three cities and administered the safety score to 1,506 adults ages 18 to 24 seen in the emergency department for any reason, and then followed them to see if they were shot or shot someone over the next 12 months. For baseline safety scores of 0, 1 to 5, and over 6, 12-month firearm violence occurred in 1.8%, 12.1%, and 25%, respectively. The area under the ROC curve for the score was 0.78, with confidence intervals from 0.72 to 0.83. The researchers identified the optimal ROC cut point was a safety score greater than 0 with sensitivity of 83% and specificity of 62%. The researchers conclude that the safety score predicts firearm violence risk in general young adult emergency department patients. Medical school tuition has increased by 750% since the 1960s, a rise three times greater than undergraduate tuition. Tuition increases reflect medical education costs, including faculty time, administration, technology, and clinical training. As a result, in 2025, 70% of medical graduates carried educational debt, largely federal loans, with a median balance of $220,000. Only 30% of students funded their education using grants and scholarships. The price of medical education shapes student decision-making in two ways. Access to medical school depends on the ability to pay tuition or assume substantial debt, and post-graduation choices of specialty and location may reflect trade-offs between debt burden and earning potential, with high-need areas in primary care offering lower compensation and slower debt repayment. In July 2025, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act revised federal student loan policies by capping medical school loans at $200,000 and lifetime student loan limits at $257,000. Because this figure closely mirrors the median medical student debt, it threatens to substantially strain an already fragile physician pipeline. This issue is discussed in a new Ideas and Opinions commentary. Valuation of healthcare services in the United States is complex and often flawed. In January 2024, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services established a new evaluation and management add-on code, G2211, aimed to better account for the previously uncompensated costs of longitudinal, non-procedural care for complex or chronic conditions provided by primary care and other specialties. Effective January 2025, preventive visits became eligible for the new code when qualifying longitudinal care was also provided. CMS estimated high uptake of G2211 because it requires no additional service provision or administrative tasks. The next article reports a study that characterized the use of this new code by specialty and payer, Using national data, they found a gradual uptake of G2211 through mid-2025 when you stabilize at approximately 27% of outpatient Medicare visits, substantially below the CMS use projections of 38% initially and 54% after several years. Use of the code among other payers in this cohort was lower than in Medicare. Finally, I want to bring two new IM Matters news articles to your attention. The first is an engaging interview with Dr. Zeke Emanuel about his recent book titled Eat Your Ice Cream, Six Simple Rules for a Long and Healthy Life. The second article addresses the current debate over the best way to administer epinephrine during an anaphylactic reaction. The article summarizes a recent discussion between two experts at the February 2026 annual meeting of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology during a session titled Stick It or Sniff It, The Great Epinephrine Debate. That brings us to the end of this podcast. I hope you go to annals.org to read some of the new articles you'll find there. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.